Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Chris Hamm, Director of the Federal Systems Integration and Management Center, FedSIM. Also joining us from IBM is Tom Bertke.
Chris, we spoke briefly about the Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program, also known as CDM. It was inaugurated as a new era of cybersecurity in the government. Would you outline the goal of the program and how agencies can leverage the program to improve their overall cybersecurity posture?
So there are two main areas of responsibility on the CDM program. The first is DHS has the programmatic responsibility. They're the people that are going to be creating the overall framework for CDM. And so each agency has an MOA with DHS in order to sign up and participate with the overall process. DHS has hired FedSIM in order to do the contract execution of it. The first meeting I had was with the former director of that office, John Stryford. And the way that he explained it still resonates today. We treated cybersecurity as a paperwork and compliance exercise, not as a actually make things safer exercise. We had to do three ring binders full of paper, and we had to do ATOs on individual systems, but it was all created and then put on a shelf somewhere. It wasn't checking to see whether or not the stuff that was going through our networks was actually the stuff that we wanted to and who was on our networks. So this is an attempt to unify the way that the entire government puts sensors and identity management throughout all of the .gov space. And that way we can actually truly measure our cybersecurity risk profile rather than just making sure that we're creating a bunch of paper that an auditor likes. Mm-hmm. The one thing that we need to get everybody focused on is there's no reason to replace this with creating your own contract. There is a government-wide BPA that's available that anybody can use, and the prices that are on that BPA, you can get a better deal through that BPA than you'll be able to get anywhere else in the market. Don't go out and create your own cyber contract. There's no reason. There's enough ceiling on it, and there's outstanding pricing, and we can, you know, give anybody who wants to buy off of it an ordering guide, show them how to get the pricing, and then help them get the stuff and put it on the networks as fast as they can. Right now, urgency should be more important than the idea of creating your own replacement cyber vehicle. So that I want folks to leave that part of the conversation with understanding that there is something that is already built that is incredibly easy to buy from, and we'll give it to you. It, you know, costs just about nothing. And the pricing you're going to see, particularly on the product side, is the scale of the government buying is one, rather than each agency buying 27 and getting the price for 27. So there are outstanding value there.
One more follow-up on CDM. While the overall structure of the program is straightforward, would you elaborate on how complex its implementation can be for other agencies?
Well, it speaks to each agency having its own technical architecture, its own priorities, and its own varying level of maturity. And we've got the pipes part of the government pretty much managed under this trusted internet connection. But then after that, each agency's got, you know, legacy infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And pre-FITARA, everybody had very decentralized authority. Mm-hmm. You know, the CIO at headquarters may not have budgetary approval or at least sign off on what the component level would do. So within each major agency, you might have, you know, one entity that's component that's ready, and then within the rest of the components, they're not ready, and they have a different technical architecture. So a lot of this is getting everyone to agree that we're all going to follow one standard. It may not be the, you know, uniform today, but by 3 years, here's our plan. Here's what we're going to implement. And then you take that within one agency and multiply that times all of the federal civilian agencies. You've got a very difficult conversation within each agency happening right now, trying to get the requirements and then agree to schedule on how they're going to implement these things. So the procurement activity isn't the hard part. It's the requirement activity. It's trying to find out which agency is going to be, you know, in what order and which group and when they're going to put, you know, each of the different phases in.
Chris, we spoke briefly previously about just the protest environment and the federal government. FedSIM has a sterling reputation for being the honest broker, as it chairs and usually represents about 40% of the technical evaluation board for FedSIM-run procurements. Are the number of protests typically lower with FedSIM procurements due to this model?
I don't have a way of assessing whether or not my protest rate is lower on similar size programs, but my initial reaction is it's probably not lower in terms of the number of protests. The difference is whether or not we're successful in the protest. I can say without a doubt that we consistently run fair procurements. Industry is very happy with the way that we define requirements, the way that we interact with them before the solicitation goes out, and how we do our evaluations. It's a very consistent process, very high quality. One thing that's interesting out of this is our incumbent capture rate is hovering around 50%. That means if you were doing the work before and you bid on the next one, whether or not you win the next competition. Part of that's because we're coming in as a trusted third party that has to read the requirements document from that client agency as if we were anybody that was cold, the same way that GAO would read it too.
Mm-hmm. I understand that recently you're going to test the FAR Part 16 pre-award pilot. You're going to do something like that. First of all, before we get into why you're doing it and what the benefit is to the stakeholders like customers, FedSIM, and industry, what is FAR Part 16?
So there, you know, anybody who wants to cure insomnia can pick up a copy of the FAR. It's a solid, thick book. It's kind of the best example of how rules beget more rules, kind of like the tax code. You know, like you write one thing and then, you know, somebody argues and make a slight change. And so it just gets more and more voluminous. Basic ordering procedures for the government tend to fall either under Part 15 or Part 8. Okay. The GSA schedule program is under Part 8. Regular full and open competition for negotiated procurements is under Part 15. Part 15 and Part 8 are, well, 8's pretty simple, but 15 is very, very detailed. Mm-hmm. It gives you a step-by-step process of all of the individual things, like I'd mentioned in the earlier segment about how you do a procurement. Part 16, however, is not detailed. Part 16 is really only a couple of paragraphs. Oh, and so the basic design, if you know, you want to get really wonky here about how acquisition works, when you create a GWAC, you create it under Part 15. Part 15 is full and open competition. Anybody in the world can bid on it. But once it's created, then all ordering happens under Part 16, not under Part 15. And so Part 16 is actually very, very light on rules. There's really only two things that are in Part 16 that are important. Anybody who's on that vehicle has a fair opportunity to be considered. So raise your hand if you're interested in bidding on this next job. And then we have to evaluate price and we have to do debriefs. Other than that, all of the steps that are in Part 15 don't exist in Part 16. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of people default to Part 15 detailed procedures because it's written and it's comfortable. And if you follow that process, generally you're going to be okay. Part 16 really doesn't have a lot of advocates and a lot of people that are willing to test. So we've decided that we're going to take one of our upcoming internal procurements where we're spending our own money and see whether or not we can understand what's permissible under Part 16. The motivation here is we want to make it faster and we want to lower our costs. We want to remove the amount of non-value-added time and energy from industry bidding on stuff and us doing paperwork. So let's start with the assumption that if they're on the vehicle already, that means they're already qualified. Somebody's already checked to see that they're a real legitimate company. You know, you take any of the major companies that are around that have, you know, buildings with their names on them on the side. They probably have the technical capability for my, you know, 10-person job kind of thing. Let's stop focusing on the corporate capabilities of them and all of the individual artifacts that were already done at the GWAC level. And let's focus on this one project. Can they do this one project? Let's interview them, see if they can do it. Let's see whether or not the teams work together. Can they actually interact with one another? And can they be assigned for the project? And what does it cost? Those three simple things, that's all you really need. So let's see if we can get through this process by just having an interview, picking the company that's best, comparing the companies to one another, which is something you generally don't do, but Part 16 doesn't forbid that. So Company A is better than Company B. We write that up. We make an award to them. So see if we can make it as simple as possible and see whether or not ultimately one of these will get challenged. So it'll go to either, you know, GSA agency or GAO or the courts and see whether or not Part 16 was intended to do this or not. This is the kind of experimentation that I was talking about earlier where, you know, if you just read the letter of the rules and then follow some of the underlying case law from GAO, what's the fastest way to get through this activity and then focus on getting the award done and delivery post-award?
Very interesting, Chris. I wish you all the best with your pilot coming up. Going back to the costing side of things, why does FedSIM stay aligned with cost plus award fee contracts? And there are times a firm fixed price might make more sense for the requirement, at least from an industry perspective. Yet FedSIM will usually stay with the cost plus award fee pricing model. Why is that?
In general, the people who write policy around contract types are not a fan of this one contract type. contract or cost plus award fee contracts are terribly difficult to administer. They require a lot of time and attention in the award process up front, and then in the post-award, you've got to have meetings to assess basically what the award fee is, or a proxy for what the profit level will be for the company on the project. So whenever you do a cost-plus award fee contract, you have to write actually a determination that basically says all of this extra work you're going to do is worth it. Mm-hmm. Why is it worth it? That's how least favored this is as a contract type. I could say at the outset that conceptually, we're agnostic on contract type. If the requirement calls for a firm fixed price, then we will do a firm fixed price. If it calls for some hybrid where you've got some of that, some time and material, or some award fee style reimbursable contracts, then we'll do that. But in practice, on the larger projects, we do use a ton of cost plus award fee. I have a colleague, Mike Donaldson, who likes to quote some Gartner stats on here on why. If you ask a government CIO what the future will be, and then later you measure them on whether or not they actually know what the future will be, in projects and what they think their responsibility will be, 5 years out, only 18% of them are right. Mm-hmm. Gartner's analysis is generally, and it should be no surprise, our market changes. Right now, we're very much in an agile software development market. We've been talking about it for a couple of years, but now we're fully in it. Whereas when we awarded contracts 5 years ago, I bet you they were waterfall. That's the design of how you did software development with an SDLC, and you followed these rigid procedures, and then when it was done, you plopped this thing in. Suddenly, the world changes. We're in agile, and if you have a firm fixed price contract, there's very little you can do within the confines of that contract. You're kind of stuck with how you were doing it. Cost does allow you a little bit more agility to make changes within, and then the award fee part helps you alter the contractor's motivation for supporting the changes. So if you're controlling the profit level, you're controlling the fee, the intent of the government is very clearly communicated in writing every 6 months. This is what we're happy with. This is what direction we're going. These are the changes that the company needs to make. And so the company will tend to be more responsive when the profit is being redirected towards new messaging around how we're going to deliver the scope. So award fee is much more flexible when you're in the larger scale programs. Smaller scale, firm fixed price, labor hour, time and materials, those things certainly have their role. But on the larger ones, we're definitely biased for cost. Mm-hmm. There's another key argument here, and it's kind of us just being contrarian on how the government went in the last couple of years. There was a lot of emphasis on LPTA, lowest price technically acceptable. And if you're in an ordering activity anywhere, the safest thing for you to do is pick the low price. As a contracting officer, it's the most risk-averse thing. You're not going to lose a protest if you pick the low price. You're just not. And so it makes your life administratively easier. You don't have protests to deal with. But it creates that lack of alignment with what's the right thing to do versus what's the easiest thing to do. We continue to do the larger projects that are always best value, tend to be with cost plus award fee. And we also include something in there where we include a cost range will prevent companies from buying in. So while the rest of the market reacted to the sequestration and budget cuts by trying to drive to the bottom, we stayed all the way over here on quality. We still care about getting the work done and having it be successful, because while you might save money on something, if it fails, it's worth nothing to you. Mm-hmm. We still care about, we might end up paying a little bit more for some of the solutions that we build, but they work. And that's much more important than having a project that completely fails.
Well, Chris, I want to go back to, you mentioned earlier that you've had some brain drain, if you will, through retirement. And it's a twofold question. One is, what types of expertise do you have on board at FedSim? But more importantly, what are you doing to replace the folks from an institutional knowledge perspective who have left?
So one is a question on how do I get the people, and the other one is how do I train them? We have been the beneficiary of the military reducing its size. Mm-hmm. There are a ton of very, very high quality civilians and enlisted folks that after their 20-year tour are ready to take an experience somewhere else. We've been hiring very heavily from the military in order to backfill and replace. Helps because a lot of our customers are going to be DOD, so they speak the language when you say J-8 or right Pat. Like, that's not a learning exercise for them like it would be somebody out of college. So we're getting incredible talent now from the military when it's its budget's being cut. They're squeezing on their personnel. But the way that I'm training them, though, a couple of years ago, I have all of those certifications that you have to have in order to be a government acquisition person, the FAC COR and FAC PPM and PMPs and all of that. And I went to one of those classes by one of the Beltway providers. And it was a retired contracting officer who was very, very smart, but, wanted to tell stories about how the A7 debacle, how the plane that was built was, the worst way of contracting. It wasn't how I do my job, and it wasn't in the systems that how I, used to do my job. So I came away frustrated, and I said, I'm going to build a replacement. We have a program called FedSim University. It is a multi-factor training program that is, some of it's online. Some of it is brown bag based. A lot of it's case study, again, Harvard Business School kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Experiential learning where you're sitting there talking about all the projects that we have. One of my favorite parts of it is we have the FedSim failures where we made our biggest mistakes, the people who made the mistakes and how they responded to their mistakes. We have some of those, every couple of months just to be able to, all right, so if this happens, here's how you fix it and here's how you avoid this from happening again.
What does the future hold for GSA's Federal Systems Integration and Management Center, or FedSim? We will ask its director, Chris Hamm, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.